welcome back to Real Crime Profile. This is a long-awaited episode 4 where we're going to answer some of the listeners' questions and deal with some other outstanding issues from making a murderer. I am Jim Clementi, and I'm a retired FBI profiler and former New York City prosecutor. And with me is...
Laura Richards, trained at New Scotland Yard and the FBI. And I have a number of degrees in forensic and legal psychology, and I set up Paladin, the National Stalking Advocacy Service.
And I'm Lisa Zambetti. I'm the casting director for Criminal Minds, where I work with Jim Clementi, and I cast killers, victims, and everything in between, and I have a true fascination with true crime and the minds here who solve those crimes. So we want to thank everybody for just the enormous
response
and feedback to our little venture here that we just kind of dived into. Thank you. And we know that we have, a learning curve to go through with this, but we're just, thrilled that people have responded.
Yeah, we really are happy that people are actually concerned about and listening to people who actually have experience investigating these kinds of crimes, and we can hopefully help you understand them better and all the nuances that surround them, especially behaviorally.
Yeah, I'd say certainly Jim has a background of investigating. I've been more doing the advice work and working alongside law enforcement. And, of course, Jim's got the background as a prosecutor as well. So my background working with thousands of victims. So certainly when we come and sit here with the microphone and in the studio, we bring a lot of our previous experience into the room. So thank you for tuning in.
And so Laura's been – do you want to talk about where you were?
Yeah, so I'm recently back from Malaysia, so I apologize to everyone. I know on the Twitter feed, everyone's been asking for when's the next episode going to drop, and I guess that's probably been down to me being in Kuala Lumpur, working with a number of NGOs and lawyers over there to helping them think about and advising around campaigning for law change. So it was a fascinating experience, and I'm going to continue to work with colleagues over there, and I'm very proud to stand shoulder to shoulder with them because the work that they do over there to change law and protect victims, they can be thrown into prison for. So it's a very different context to what my three law changes have been in, where I'm allowed freedom of speech and expression and to change things with the victim's voice at the centre of it. So they are maybe small in stature, some of the women I was working with there, but they're giants in the field of human rights and standing up for injustice.
All right, so let's get into some of the listener questions.
Sure. Yeah, we had some questions posted on our Facebook page that we would love to share with you. So, from David Cole, with regard to Avery's blood found in Teresa's car, if it was implanted, how do you explain the lack of fingerprints? And then he goes on to say, that combined with the officer who called in the license plate really bothers me. Also, it seems like the officer was blinking a lot when he was on the stand. I've heard that can be an indication of nervousness and dishonesty. So we have two questions there.
Okay, well, actually... I'll deal with the last part because the recency effect. The fact is that blinking can be, at times, an indicator of deception. But you have to norm each individual. And plus, you have to look at the situation in which you find that person. In other words, if somebody's talking to you in normal life as you're walking down the street or you're sitting around having a beer, that's one thing. But when you're on the stand being examined by a defense attorney who's adversarial in nature, then you may show signs of stress, because that's what indicators of deception actually are. They're signs of stress that the person undergoing or speaking or reacting nonverbally is undergoing stress at the time. So it could be an indicator of deception at that time, but it could also be the stress of being on the stand and actually being caught in doing things that you maybe shouldn't have done or maybe weren't that you weren't professionally proud of. So in this case, like Officer Colburn, when he called it in, when they were talking about that, he erroneously said, I thought the woman on the dispatcher actually said that it was a 94 RAV4, as opposed to the fact of the matter, which he was corrected on, that he actually volunteered that information.
And so we're actually going to get way deep into this. This question
will.
And other similar questions actually spawned another episode that will be coming at you soon. So thank you for that question. And you want to respond to the first part?
So the first part about the blood, why were there no fingerprints? Well, the cut on Stephen Avery's hand was at the back of his hand. And so the blood, he could have transferred that from his finger when he was, let's say, turning the car key, because it was right in that spot of the car where you could hit your knuckle against the actual dashboard of the car while you're turning the key. So that would not leave any fingerprints. But it could also be that he had that he was wearing gloves, but he cut his hands. So the gloves would have covered his fingerprint areas, but if he cut his knuckle on the back of his finger, it may have cut through the glove and bled onto the glove and then onto the car. So the fact that there were no fingerprints tells me that somebody, if Avery was in the car, he was probably wearing gloves at the time, but he could have cut his knuckle, the back of his hand, touched the car with that bloody surface, transferred the blood there, and there wouldn't be no fingerprints.
Yeah, I mean, I think the whole forensic side is so problematic. So actually, I share in these questions, and I'm not sure we have all the answers, because obviously some of the things we've seen have been presented in the documentary. Some of the things were presented at trial, and there's further evidence and information that we've read separately. And certainly there still are some answers that are missing, that we can all hypothesise on why. You know, why did the key, for example, just have, you know, Avery's
forensics is another key question.
Yep.
Yeah. So we will do our best to cover these questions today, and then we will have other episodes where we actually delve into specific aspects of this case and hopefully get a better understanding of these forensic details that we're talking about right now.
Thanks, David Cole, for that. We're going to move on to my favorite name ever, Booyah Kasha. That's great. She says, great discussion. I feel based on the remains on the property that Stephen is probably guilty with no other explanation put forward as to how her burned bones got there. The question I had about her remains is, how do you theorize about one bone, if I'm remembering correctly, that was found across town on another property that had nothing to do with the Averys? I never heard that.
Well, actually, I think maybe she was mistaken about the cross town part of it. It was across property. It was actually found in the gravel pit, and that was located, I believe it was at the far end of the Avery property. And also, there were bone fragments found in the burn barrel that was at the Dassey's home right across the yard from Steve Avery's fire pit and Steve Avery's home. So let me talk a little bit about my theory about what most likely happened with respect to burning and attempting to completely decimate this body. What people don't understand is that to get rid of a body, to actually turn it into nothing but ashes, is a very difficult and long process. When somebody is cremated, it's at a very high rate of temperature and it is for a sustained period of time. You have to constantly add fuel to that fire. So I believe her body was placed on that fire, and I believe that it wasn't completely burned. And I think that's the typical thing that happens. When the fire burns down, it was a big fire pit, there was a lot of tires and wood and other things thrown on it, branches and so forth, and furniture even. And I think that would have kept the fire going for a long time, but not long enough. And I think the killer then took the body parts that weren't yet completely decimated by the fire and put them in a burn barrel and had a more smaller controlled fire in the burn barrel. And then took the burn barrel out to the back to the gravel pit and dumped it there. And then there were still some fragments left in the muck at the bottom of the burn barrel. The burn barrel is out in the open, so it rains and snows in there, and then it melts, and then it creates this ash and water muck at the bottom, and any bone fragments that got stuck in there stayed in there, and they were found later. So that's why there was three different locations where bone fragments were found.
And this tags on to one other Twitter question about the smell of burning flesh would have been pungent.
Sure. I mean, it certainly would have been. Do you mind if I go?
Yeah, go ahead.
Do you want to go? I was just going to say that, you know, there would have been a pungent smell. I mean, burning flesh, and it's a horrible thing to have to talk about, but it's a reality with this case and a practical point. But if he were burning rubber tyres, you know, that particular noxious smell, that would be very pungent, and that may well overtake and be the dominant smell. And, of course,
absolutely,
if he were used to doing this activity, no one would ask any questions about it anyway.
Right. And Brendan Dassey did say that they were burning tires that day. The thing about burning tires, once you set them on fire, they will burn for a number of hours. And they burn very hot, and they burn with a thick, acrid black smoke. And it covers a lot of other smells and a lot of other things. So I believe that could have been a forensic countermeasure used by the killer, and it could also have been the fuel, the long-standing fuel that would have helped to burn the body to the extent it was actually burned.
And it goes back to sort of the plain sight theory, you know, of just doing everyday activities that are very normal, that no one would say, oh, on this day I saw, you know, such and such happening, because actually it was just a regular and routine activity. Mm-hmm. They're at a salvage yard. They're going to try and destroy certain things that they don't need anymore.
Shall we move on? We have another question from Michael Semeraro. He says, I just started listening to your podcast. It's great. Thank you. I have a question. I don't understand how Avery and nephew can get convicted of the same murder proved to be done in two different ways at two separate trials. Can someone explain?
Well, I asked the same exact question of other prosecutor friends of mine. And it's actually legitimate for a prosecutor, if the defendant's trials are separated, to actually argue different theories in different trials. So you can separate the trials so that they're not tried together, and then you can bring evidence against each one that is admissible against that particular defendant. It may not be admissible against the other defendant, and that's one of the reasons why they might want to separate the trials. So it's sort of a strategy move in one way, and it sounds illogical, mm-hmm. but in fact, the criminal justice system is not absolutely logical. There are things, there are rules in place that are meant to protect the defendant's rights, and in the end, in certain cases, they may actually work against a particular defendant. So I think that's what happens here.
I mean, I thought it was odd. Some of these things, I wasn't sure whether it's a U.S. thing.
Have you heard of this happening in the U.K.? Or?
Not so much. And I thought it was interesting because I picked up on the prosecution constantly saying there's only one person who committed this murder, mm-hmm. and that person is Stephen Avery. And yet they had, you know, a year down the line, obviously the trial for Brendan Dassey. And I found that a peculiarity.
I did too.
You know, why not talk about both of them? And I know that we've got another question that we're going to cover around, you know, the defence of why they couldn't talk about other suspects. So some of these things, you know, is it an anomaly to the US or is it actually just...
Yeah, why don't you raise that question now?
So Stephen Avery has a statement that says it's obvious who it was and that, you know, there are other suspects that are more viable than he. So why couldn't the defence bring that up?
Well,
apparently, they had a pretrial hearing in which the prosecution was successful in preventing the defense from actually raising the names of other suspects. To me, that's unconscionable. To me, that is exactly what the defense should be doing and is exactly what the system should be allowing them to do. I don't understand why they allowed that to happen in this case.
The judge ruling it,
right.
Ruling on it specifically.
But
so this
is
an anomaly, you would say.
Yes, but I would think that's one of the issues that would be brought in a habeas corpus petition in federal court saying that his rights were violated. If he was not allowed to actually defend himself by naming other viable suspects, it happens in thousands and thousands of other murder trials. I don't understand why it didn't happen in this, and I think that it's a ruling that could cause problems for the prosecution and may end up getting Steve Avery another trial.
And it's an interesting point on two levels, because as far as I was aware, Stephen Avery was positing that Chuck had reason to frame him, his brother. So that's who he sort of named as a suspect. But the letter that he wrote after his new defense lawyer had visited him in prison, and incidentally there was a whole media circus there, which just happened to be there, and she gave some very clear statements to. But she came out with a letter from Stephen Avery, and that's the one that you referred to, where he does say, you know, thank you to all my supporters, that, you know, he's basically... concerned about the fact that everybody knows who the real suspect is here and that the police had never investigated because they were so intent on proving that it was him, just like they did
Which
in
is
the
a
first
callback, yeah.
trial.
Well, yeah.
Yeah, so he's getting people to relate to that. And she's tweeted that. Mm. So I'm not sure who exactly, you know, he's referred to Chuck, obviously, in the first instance, but the start of that letter says, I did not kill Teresa Holbeck, or nor did anybody else in my family. And then...
What?
Yeah. So okay. It's an interesting... You can see it on Twitter. I mean, it's on Kathleen Zellner's
So that's
Twitter
a little page. Thing that we'd call inconsistent. Although Brendan Dassey, sadly, does not know what that means, nor does his mother, it doesn't mean the same thing. Those are two things that are contradictory, okay? This was the level of their understanding of the situation. They did not even know what the word inconsistent meant. And so I think that that's another story for another day, right. But we'll get into it.
Should we move on to the key? So someone on Twitter had the key with only Stephen Avery's DNA, not even Teresa's DNA on it.
First of all, it's not the key. The key had nobody's DNA on it. There's a DNA sample taken from the fob. It's like a webbed cloth fob that held the key, held the key ring, actually. And so that is, it's curious because if Teresa Hoback owned this key, and then she would have had to have handled it and would have likely left her DNA on it. So there's a possibility that it was cleaned. And it could have been cleaned because somebody was forensically sophisticated enough to know that there would be DNA on it. Or it could have been cleaned because it fell in blood, or it had blood stains on it, or was taken out of bloody pants, or it was burned in a fire. I don't know what it was, but for some reason, it seems like it was cleaned thoroughly and then touched by Steve Avery, or his DNA was planted on it somehow.
What about if there was, and this is something that's been posited on Twitter and YouTube, what if there was a sub-key, there was a second key? Because there was a picture that was of her out, stood by her car with a bunch of keys. I think she had two sets of keys in her hand, and it looked like, you know, car keys, but with other keys on it.
Yeah, there were multiple keys on the ring, right.
But this key didn't have multiple.
No.
It was like a spare
one
key, like you keep in your house in
it
case you...
It could be, or it could be that it's kept in the glove compartment or the little console in the middle of the two front seats. It could have been that, and it could have been found by somebody and taken out elsewhere. It could have been found by Steve Avery. It could have been found by somebody else. It could have been found by a police officer. I don't know.
But it does seem strange. I mean, I'll give you an analogy. If I'm stood by my car and I'm getting into my car, I'm going to probably be holding either my house keys, you know, with my car keys or my car keys because I'm getting into the vehicle. And that picture looks like she's getting into the vehicle.
Sure.
But it's not the same key fob.
Right.
You know, so it leads me to believe that this key has come from somewhere else?
Yeah,
all
right. However.
Not inverted commas.
Not inverted commas, okay. However, what if, let me give you a scenario that's plausible. What if the killer found her key set, didn't want to keep all her other keys, got rid of them, took that one key and put it on his own key fob to keep it because he thought, I'm going to drive the car to this holding place right now, and then later I'll get rid of it, and I want to make sure I have the key. So he just put it on his own key fob. That would make a lot of sense. That's why only his DNA was on the key fob. It could have been his key fob to begin with, and he got rid of the other keys.
But the other keys probably would have ended up in the burn barrel with the other items that she had.
Possibly, but their keys are very disposable. I mean, you can drop them off anywhere. You can toss them in a lake. You can... They could be buried on the property somewhere and not found. So
got it. Okay.
It's possible.
It's a possibility.
Yeah. Who knows?
There was a question about why were some of Teresa's voicemails deleted and by whom? And I also want to lead into the did she have a stalker?
Yeah, this certainly intrigued me. You know, we had a big case of Millie Dowler and her voicemails being deleted, and it ended up in a big inquiry called the Leveson Inquiry. And I certainly found this interesting that somebody has, and we know that her brother and her previous boyfriend managed to get her logon details and go into her phone records. So, I mean, this could all be a red herring in the sense that they go into her phone records because they're trying to find out where she is. And maybe they get into her voicemail too and they hear things that may embarrass her, for example. But again, if they don't know where she is, it's a very odd thing
it
to
is.
Do if they then delete. But there's another question that I had, certainly, and with my background around stalking behaviours and understanding, you know, victims' reactions. There's an account from one of her work colleagues who says very clearly that, and he testifies to this, that she was getting phone calls from somebody and it was causing her distress. And she wouldn't say exactly who it was, but when the number was flashing up, she knew who it was coming from and she was trying to get rid of the calls and saying, oh, no, not again. And that she seemed to, when she was questioned about it, she said it's just somebody who's causing her, you know, some problems. And she wasn't sort of pushed on the point, although he could see that it was actually causing her a lot of distress. And I still query why, you know, her phone records weren't pulled by the police to see what numbers were calling her, you know,
and
who
when.
She was speaking to and when. You know, why would someone delete voicemails when she's a missing person at this point?
So nobody has those phone records? I mean, those were never pulled?
I have no idea, but it's certainly something that's questioned in court as to another line of investigation that wasn't pursued. So I can't make any assumptions here other than the fact that it appears that nothing was offered, you know, certainly by the investigators around them pursuing that line of inquiry, where you would expect them, if they were keeping an open mind, that they would have looked at her phone records and her billing, and they would have heard from the work colleague about this possible stalker, and it would have been a line of inquiry that they would have pursued rigorously, because this could well take them to the person who has abducted and killed Teresa.
Right. Especially during the time frame where her car and her body had not yet been discovered. But I too thought that the motivation might have been because whatever these emails or voicemails, were potentially embarrassing to the family, to Teresa. They wanted to protect her for some reason. But also they could be because the ex-boyfriend could have been the one making the calls. Who knows?
Well, we don't know. I mean, he certainly was industrious in being part of the searches. He was never was an eyebrows raised around him, you know, and I think that's part of what the defence was saying, that they couldn't go down the line of talking about other suspects or naming them, but there certainly seemed to be some lines of investigation and inquiry that were not pursued.
Yeah, definitely.
Can I ask a question that I got from Twitter, and it was about the phone call with Jody on the night of the murder. Explain how he could be calm during that phone call. And I think this, if you, we'll actually go into this.
Yeah, this spurred an entire podcast of its own.
We will do an entire podcast on this, on Jody's interview.
Mm-hmm.
Post making a murder and her disclosures about what was going on during the relationship.
And she talks about that.
But one of the things that she describes is that he is a sort of a Jekyll and Hyde character. And this phone call, if he is the murderer, and he had this 15-minute phone call with Jody while she was in prison that night, and he was calm during it, well, if that's the case, then this is a perfect example of the Jekyll and Hyde character. In other words, he's able to present himself as a calm, cool, collected, nice guy when he wants to, and a monster at other times. So we'll have to reserve a complete answer to this question till a further podcast. But thanks for the question.
And I think this was like an amalgamation of several questions. So, Jim, you had talked before about, you know, there was no blood spray in the garage, so you didn't really think she'd been shot there. And so some people are thinking, well, what do you think happened to her physically? I mean, where was this all done?
When somebody is shot, then there is a entrance wound, and there will be blowback, high-velocity blood spatter that comes out of that wound. And if there's an exit wound, there will be high-velocity blood spatter that's blown out of that wound. And so these droplets are so small. Some of them might be microscopically small, but at least pinpoint size because of the velocity of the bullet. So those things would be hard to find so that you could clean them up. And so that's a very difficult thing to do, unless you did a massive overall cleanup with bleach. And I know Brendan Dassey said that he had bleach stains on his pants from the fact that Stephen Avery had asked him to help clean up the floor of the garage, and they did that with bleach and I think kerosene and gasoline. Being shot doesn't necessarily mean that's how you're killed. Mm-hmm. You can be shot and survive. You can be shot after you're dead, and you can be shot and killed. Those are three opportunities. Now, for example, why would somebody want to shoot somebody after they're already dead? Well, unfortunately, in this case, the offender put the victim's body on a fire and was trying to destroy it. But there are big, massive bones in the body, like the hips and the skull. And he could have shot those bones to break them up so that they would burn better. And that's just a harsh reality. Mm-hmm. So that could have been when she was actually shot. And then there wouldn't be any bloodstains on the garage.
I mean, I think it's a very interesting thing, people hypothesizing about how she was killed. And certainly the fact that Brendan Dassey says that her throat was cut, well, we're not taking into account what Brendan said because we know he's been led by investigators right. and others.
And we'll do a whole episode just on that.
On that in particular. But certainly, you know, my view on it is that there doesn't necessarily need to be a lot of blood. It could be that the method of kill was actually strangulation. And if we think that she was sexually assaulted or raped, and that's what was motivating this particular offence, and then she rejects him. I certainly know from reviewing and analysing hundreds of domestic violence murders, sadly, that the most common method of kill is through from a male on a female is strangulation. And it's a physicality thing. And so this is how she may well have been killed. And she may have been stabbed too, but I doubt that that did happen. I don't think we're talking about a huge amount of blood, and I certainly don't think that they could have, or law enforcement or anyone else could have recreated the crime scene in terms of the burn sites. Yeah. So I think we have to separate here.
Can I say something on that particular point about recreating the crime scene because of the burn sites?
Yeah, let me just finish one point, though, because it's quite important that I think we need to separate out the things that we've heard from Brendan Dassey's account. And, of course, there have been numerous accounts across time, which, as Jim said, we will go into. But what are the things he's really been led on that now people think are fact? Because even Kathleen Zellner is tweeting about her Teresa Halbeck's throat being cut, but there is no indication, certainly from the forensic side, but we know there are problems with forensics, but there's no indication that that happened. And if we believe Jodie's account and Laurie's accounts that Stephen Avery would strangle women, he would choke them, I've certainly seen scores of cases where women have been strangled and choked, sometimes manually, sometimes using dog leads or leashes, prior to them being murdered. And when they are murdered, that's the method of kill that has been used. So that corroborates. So go ahead, Jim. Jump in.
There's a theory that that Steve Avery's burn pit was actually a secondary disposal site and not the primary disposal site. In other words, that she was burned somewhere else and somebody planted the bones there behind Stephen's house. Well, to me, the single piece of evidence that tends to absolutely destroy that theory is the presence of the rivets from her jeans in that burn pit. In other words, if somebody had burned her body elsewhere and then dug up the bones or picked up the bones and then brought them over to this house, I believe that the chances of them also finding and picking up the rivets from her jeans and putting them in the pit is almost nil. Mm-hmm. There's almost no chance in hell that that happened. And so I believe that tiny little aspect of forensic evidence actually proves that that was the primary disposal site, that she was actually burned with her clothes in that pit.
We want to thank you for all those great questions. Keep them coming. We're Definitely. Certainly going to keep answering them. And coming down the line for us is two more podcasts that we've already got in the can regarding that interview on Nancy Grace's show with Jodie, and also a really deep dive on something that Laura noticed in the audio tapes from the discovery of Teresa's car. So we have two separate podcasts on those subjects. And then the next case we're going to go into is...
Is that the drum roll?
Yep.
O.J. Simpson.
That's right. Now, I brought this subject up. I had no idea what Jim was going to tell me about this case, if he even had anything to say about it. And oh my goodness, I can't wait to get into this with him and you. I just... Things I absolutely never knew. And Laura also opened up a whole vault of fascinating things. So if you're not aware, there is a miniseries on television produced by Ryan Murphy, who I worked for. And so I was super excited to see it. And it's called The People versus O.J. Simpson. And I've been watching it. I think we're on episode 3 or 4 right now. And you guys have not watched it yet, correct?
I've not seen it. No. It wasn't allowed to be streamed in Malaysia. But I certainly looked at some things. And obviously it's a 21-year anniversary as well.
Yeah.
Yeah. So... Yeah, I have not watched the series yet, but I will before our podcast and so forth. But I do have some of the behind-the-scenes information about the case, and I think there are some really interesting things that went on. And also, I think this was a watershed moment in law enforcement history, and we'll discuss that.
Right.
when we do the podcast.
So we have a lot of great things coming down the pike. There is a question I wanted to ask you. Slightly off topic. So it's a question, a form of a question that I get a lot when people find out that I cast for a show that has so much violence in it. And week after week, I have to read just the most horrifying and, you know, degrading things that humanity has to offer. You know, how do I stay sane being around all that material? But I kind of want to turn it on you guys, and I have no idea what you're going to say. But, you know, you've had all these experiences. You've seen things that you cannot unsee. You have just been through the most horrific cases. How do you stay sane? And, you know, conversely, how do you not become desensitized to it? I'm just very curious about how you deal with that.
I think it's a very good question. And in fact, the women I was working in Malaysia with asked me that question. Every training session I run, I'm asked, how do I look after myself? Mm. And certainly how do, you know, what measures do I put in place for my team back at home? Who cares for the carers, if you like? Because you can have vicarious trauma that occurs when you are subjected to what's very toxic and corrosive material. So, I mean, certainly some of the measures that we put in place, we actually have a clinical psychologist who is trauma-informed, who works with all of my team back in the UK and works with me. And that acts as a safe place where we can put this stuff, because it's not... it's not the right thing to do to talk to our parents and our loved ones, you know, and our family members and our partners about this type of material and people's lives. But there's also a lot to be said. Lots of people who know me know I'm really big into physical sport and activity of running and British military fitness and physical activity that boosts the serotonins and the endorphins. You know, there's a lot of self-care that does have to go into it, because you can end up having a very biased view of the world. And if you don't take care of yourself, you can't really be in a position to take care of others. So given that I'm still an advocate, I still work with victims, even though, you know, I have a whole service to do that now. We have victims contacting us every week who are in crisis and trauma, and everything that we do is trauma-informed, and therefore the people that we have around us are also trauma-informed. So there's a lot of debriefing that also can go on as well with people who work in a similar... certainly when I worked in law enforcement in the police, there was lots of debriefs that also went on, dare I say it, in the pub, which actually psychologists have found is a very healthy way of debriefing. That, you know, you can get into sort of... it's almost to decompress. You have to talk to people who have a shared experience that you have as well. So that can also be very beneficial. I'm certainly not advocating, you know, go and sink a bottle of wine. But sometimes there's something about the socialisation and being able to talk to somebody who's got a shared experience that means that you can lessen the load.
Yeah, and I would just say, first of all, I hate to tell you this, but what we write in those scripts on Criminal Minds, although a lot of it is based on real cases, blended cases and so forth, it's actually watered down from the reality. The reality is actually much more graphic and much worse than what ends up in a script. There is something that we have to do in this field, and that's called develop a clinical detachment. And that doesn't mean that we don't care about the victims or the families. We're doing it for the victims and the families. But if we get emotionally involved in the crimes that we're investigating, what happens is it clouds your judgment. You're not able to see the behavioral details that you need to see, and the minuscule little nuances that you need to see in order to solve these crimes and prevent this from happening to somebody else. So you develop a clinical detachment just the same way that surgeons do when they're operating on somebody's body. They look at everything else is covered up. Only the part that they're operating on is actually exposed to them. And that helps them just focus on that part and let other people take care of the anesthesiologist takes care of keeping them alive but pain-free, and other people look at their vitals and so forth, but the surgeon is just focusing on the surgery, and we have to do that exact same thing. And one of the ways, like Laura, I feel like I have to find balance in my life, and I think for a while I didn't. I mean, unfortunately, I got cancer, I had a heart attack and cardiac arrest. I see now that I'm very lucky to have survived those things, and I do lecture to law enforcement groups across the country and around the world, actually, about the fact that they need to balance their lives. When you're living in this sort of dark world of crime and some of the most horrendous things that humans can do to other humans, you really have to balance that out. And one of the ways I used to do it was with restoration. I used to buy old homes and buildings and restore them. And I love to put in that hard physical labor. Actually helped me, you know, release some of that horrible stuff that was in me. And then at the end, you could look at what you've done and it's actually improved something or restoring it to its original beauty. And to me, that was a sense of accomplishment. And actually, we put that in to one of the characters, right. Derek Morgan on Criminal Minds. The thing that I've done since then, because I don't do much of that anymore, is writing. Writing is an incredibly cathartic release for me. And even writing about horrible crimes and so forth can be, you know, a release. And it can be, it's a creative way to do something positive with negative information. And in fact, I wrote my story as a novel, and it's called Without Consent. And that is, it's basically a novelized version of how I became an FBI agent, how I went from being a prosecutor to an FBI agent. So anyway, between construction and writing, I think that's how I find my balance. And I think that most healthy law enforcement, long-term law enforcement professionals have to find that some way. All right.
Well, thank you for those answers. I appreciate it.
All right. Well, all right. Thank you for your time. Mm-hmm. And we've had a great discussion today. And I will definitely tell listeners there is definitely more to come on Making a Murderer. And then we're going to move on to other topics. But we will keep tabs on what's going on in Steve Avery's case and Brendan Dassey's case.
That's right. It's a developing story, yeah. So we'll definitely dip back into that as things emerge.
And just before we close, can I give a plug to a consultation that's happening at home in the UK that Paladin have been campaigning for, a register for serial stalkers and serial domestic violence offenders and new protective orders. So not the same as restraining orders, but similar orders that protect victims from sex offenders, that place a positive obligation on them so that they're supervised, managed and tracked. And the Home Office launched a consultation at the end of December, and this consultation is open to everybody, to the public, to law enforcement, to advocacy services like Paladin and specialist domestic violence services, but also just to the public. So if you're listening and you're in the UK, please do complete it. It closes on February the 29th. You can go onto the Paladin website, www.paladinservice.co.uk. You can have a look at our response, and please submit your response and mention the register and that you'd like to see these orders the same as we have a register for sex offenders. So that's my little plea. Thank you.
You know, we almost forgot something really important. Wait,
and there is one other thing. Speaking of writing, I did write an episode of Criminal Minds that's airing Wednesday, February 24th at 9 p.m. on CBS.
That's right.
And that is the kind of writing that, unfortunately, has to do with death and destruction. But I believe that we are able to reach millions of people across this country and around the world and tell them what offenders are really like, so they can learn from the real cases that myself and my colleagues investigated.
So please watch the episode, and you can leave us a Facebook message about it or Twitter, tweet us.
At Real Crime Profile without the E, or at Laura Richards 99, or
at Jim Clemente.
Thanks, you guys.
Thank you.
Take care.
Real Crime Profile is produced and edited by Paul Francis Sullivan, engineered by Jacob Moose Molin. Music is composed and performed by Simba Sumba. Logo art by Rob Cohen. Real Crime Profile is produced and recorded at Empire Studios LA by XG Productions.